for Thursday, December 8th, 2016. This is the Perpetual Notion Machine. I'm your host, Kai Burrito. And for this edition of PNM, I'll be joined by Sandra Kinzer in our interview with UW-Madison PhD candidate Carly Zeter. Enjoy.
Her research explores how we interact with our landscape in increasingly urban environments and what benefits we get from the nature around us. So we'll be getting into the specifics of her research and learn all about how Carly is making an impact on the planet. Carly, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Carly Zeter. So as you just heard, I'm a PhD candidate here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and it's great to be here today.
Nice. So have you ever been on radio before?
I actually have been, but not for several years, so I'm a little bit rusty.
All right. So Kai will start us off with a discussion here. And his first question.
Yes. Can you tell us what exactly is an ecosystem service and how does that affect the city of Madison?
So an ecosystem service, you can think of it as the benefits that we get from nature or from ecosystems. So if you think about things like clean water, flood protection, temperature control, even food, all of the ecosystems around us have a huge part in providing these benefits. And so I actually study these things in the city, right here in Madison. I'm an urban ecologist. And urban areas are sometimes kind of ignored. You know, we think of them as a concrete jungle, these places that exist separately from nature, but really we're surrounded by it. So all of these little patches of green in and around the city are benefiting us here in Madison every day.
So we talked a bit about urban ecosystem services. What does this mean for the rural communities? Because Wisconsin has a lot more rural communities than it does just urban centers. So, I mean, when you think of the urban centers, I think of Milwaukee and I think of, you know, Madison, maybe some throw in some like La Crosse, Green Bay and Wausau, Appleton area. But, you know, a lot of the state, you know, living in areas maybe with like under 100,000 people. So what does it mean for the rural areas?
Yeah, so absolutely. So there's a kind of two different issues, right? And so we certainly have a lot of research going on in Madison, in these more rural areas and in the more agricultural areas. And what I was really interested in is how is this different from the city, or what kind of parallels can we draw? And so when I came to Madison, I actually didn't expect to be working in the city. I came to join this much larger project called Water Sustainability and Climate in the Yahara. And it focuses on the entire Yahara watershed, which, as you mentioned, is mostly rural, is mostly this farmland and small communities. And when I started really thinking about, you know, what should I do for my PhD, I realized we had this really incredible research going on in these agricultural areas on ecosystem services, but not much had really been done yet in the city. And so I kind of took that as my little piece of the puzzle to work on. And I'm really glad I did, because I've become absolutely fascinated with the city. But you're right that we can't kind of take it outside of that context. We need to think about the city and think about the surrounding areas.
Right. It's almost like you found your perfect niche here. But one question I have for you. So when you came here, were you intending to work on this project or just like fall into your, was it like good fortune that you fell into this?
I would say it was a mix of both. So in terms of the people that I wanted to work with and, you know, my advisor and the bigger picture issues that I wanted to study, that was very intentional. I knew I wanted to study ecosystem services. I knew I wanted to work with Monica Turner and Chris Kucharik and the professors here that I work with. But I didn't know that I'd be, you know, studying the urban heat island or studying soil specifically.
Yeah, and we'll get into the reasons why. But one last question before we lose sight of the urban ecosystem services. So ecosystem services research seems to be a fairly new research area. In one of your papers, I saw the majority of the studies have been conducted within the last decade. So what questions still exist that researchers need to understand about the topic of ecosystem services?
So that's a huge question. And we could probably talk about that for the whole show.
I did not realize that.
Oh, no, that's okay.
Can we extend it to 2 hours?
Yeah, no, we're not extending it to 2 hours.
Maybe I can come back another day. So I think in terms of ecosystem services being new, I would say it's new terminology and kind of new packaging. But the idea of ecosystems being of benefit to people and the idea that we rely on nature has actually been around for a very long time. And so in terms of calling them ecosystem services and really studying them in the frameworks we think about them now, a lot of that came about in around 2005 when the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment came out, which maybe you've heard of.
I did, coming across some of your research. That's when I saw I saw this initial paper that was published in 1986, and then I just had to see, like, no more research, put out about it. And then it, like, hits back again at that time frame.
So some of that, I think the paper you're referring to of mine is specifically on urban ecosystem services.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Urban is kind of the tail end, I guess. We started researching ecosystem services mostly in natural areas, in what we call production systems. So, like, agriculture and forests and areas that are really producing things for us.
Right.
And then cities kind of came late to the game. We had written them off a little bit, I think, for the most part. And recently, there's been kind of a resurgence in urban ecology and urban ecosystem services, which is, it's really exciting to be kind of part of a field that's still taking off and where there are still so many open questions.
Yeah, we're going to let Sandra take off and give you some of her questions.
Yeah, I have some of my own questions. So I wanted to start off just like, what's a typical day like for you? Do you just go into a lab and then like sit there all day? Or like, what do you do?
Yeah, so one of the things I love about being a scientist is that there isn't really one kind of typical day, but I would say I have two kind of main types of day. And so one would be, you know, during the school year, during the semester, where I'm usually in my office kind of working with data and meeting with other collaborators and teaching students. I'm a TA here as well. And then the other type of day I have is during the field season. And so I'm a field ecologist, which means basically, I work outside taking data, taking samples, and that doesn't change just because you work in the city. I still, you know, put on my field gear and go out there and take samples, but the logistics definitely change a little bit.
Nice. So where did this all begin for you, like your interest in ecology? Was it like back in high school, or how did you become interested in the environment?
So I would say my interest in the environment goes back kind of as long as I can remember. I have always been really fascinated with the outdoors since I was a kid. You know, I was always outside climbing trees and playing in the mud and helping my dad in the garden. And then at the same time, when you grow up in our generation, and maybe you kind of have some familiarity with this too, but you hear a lot about all these environmental problems. So from a very young age in school, you hear, oh, there's problems with litter and there's problems with pollution and with climate change. And the line that you always hear is like, it's up to your generation to fix it. And I guess I kind of internalized that. And I thought, you know, if it's up us to, I'm tripping over my words here. If it's up to us to fix it, I want to be a part of that. And so I think ecology was kind of a natural fit for me.
Yeah, nice. So one other thing I wanted to mention, I was looking on your website and you were awarded a National Geographic Young Explorers Award. First of all, what did you get that for?
Yeah, so that's an award that National Geographic gives out to young kind of beginning researchers to do really exploratory field work. So do some field work in kind of a new system. And so you write a grant proposal. And I got that work for some research I'm doing on an invasive species here in Madison that some people may have heard about. It's called the Asian jumping worm.
I have not heard of that.
And yeah.
Can you tell us about it? Stalking through your research page.
Well,
so.
Yeah. So the
what is it?
The Asian jumping worm, it's an earthworm. And so it's an earthworm
does
species.
It, jump?
It does. And so it's really fascinating. You always hear about people talking about charismatic megafauna, which are like whales and tigers, and I call it like charismatic microfauna. It's this tiny little worm, but it just like squirms and writhes and jumps off the soil. But we actually, it's been in the U.S. for quite a while, but we only found it in Wisconsin a couple of years ago in 2013. And the first site that they found it was the UW-Madison Arboretum, so right here in the middle of the city. And so it's an area of research that has been worked on for the last couple of years by folks in the Arboretum and in my lab. And so I've been doing a project looking at the impacts that this worm might have and how it might interact with other species. I actually was a little bit shocked that I won the award, in that usually you get these awards for kind of going off to these really exotic places. And I wanted to study like worms pretty much in my backyard. And I thought there's no way that they'll be interested in this. And it's really encouraging that they are, that they see the value of kind of local conservation. And I call myself a backyard explorer.
Yep. Yeah, that's where you got to start, though. So you do that like alongside all your PhD stuff?
Yeah, so that's a piece of my PhD. And so basically any PhD project you have has different chapters, which are each kind of a different but related project under one theme. So you have anywhere from about 3 to 5 of these different projects. And so all of mine have to do with this idea of urban ecology and ecosystem services, but the pieces can be pretty different.
Gotcha. I've never done a PhD, so I wouldn't know. But
we're not done with our undergrad yet.
Well, I mean,
we will be soon.
Most people don't have much of an idea of what it's like, you know, in the day-to-day of a PhD. So it's always exciting to talk about that.
The acronym PhD stands for piled higher and deeper, correct?
I believe so.
I think that's right.
Just kidding. PhD joke here. So you mentioned that there's different chapters as part of your graduate research. So do you want to talk about a little bit about each of those chapters and the project associated with them?
Sure. So I'll give you the brief overview, and then we can decide what to talk about. And so the first...
It's probably a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot in there. But the first one is a paper you briefly mentioned already, which was kind of a global review paper looking at urban ecosystem services and basically summarizing the studies that have already been done. So thinking about when we're thinking about biodiversity, so the number and types of species that are in our cities and their relationship to ecosystem services, what's kind of the state of the science? What have we learned from all of these studies around the world? And then what are the future directions? And so that was where I started. And then I have 3 additional projects that are ongoing. And so one has to do with soil. And so it's thinking about the benefits that we get from soil. So the dirt under our feet is incredibly important for things like purifying our water, storing carbon, preventing flooding. And so I look at how these benefits vary across the city and in different types of green space. And so basically, when I say green space, which is something I'll probably say a lot, I mean everything from like parks to the arboretum to golf courses and backyards all through the city. And I look at how these benefits might change over time, too, these benefits we get from our soil. And then the next project I work on has to do with something called the urban heat island. And so when you build a city, you basically take an area that's covered with soil and plants, and you turn it into an area with a lot of asphalt and bricks and concrete. And what all those surfaces do is make it hotter. I mean, think about standing in like a parking lot on a summer day compared to a park. But temperature isn't just different kind of between the city and in the rural areas, but within the city. And so I look again at these types of green spaces and especially at trees and how they cool the city off. And this might seem like kind of a minor thing, but hotter cities, especially during things like heat waves, can have really big consequences for people's health and things like energy use and pollution. So we think about how can we kind of plan our cities better or where can we plant trees to reduce that effect. And then the last one is the invasive species that I just talked about. And so it's looking at these, our friends, the jumping worms. And how they might interact with another invasive species, a shrub called buckthorn, and whether they might feed off each other to create more consequences for the city. And so that's basically the gist of it. We've got soil and heat islands and worms and all here in Madison.
Well, I want to know a little bit of all of them, but we're going to start off with the soil. So. Yeah. Looking into some of your research, you take a soil corer and you go around, and sometimes you have to knock door to door and ask permission to collect samples. You want to explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I call it door to door field work. And so for my soil work, it was really important to me to collect samples from all these different types of green spaces. So a lot of urban ecology only gets done in kind of parks and public places, because it's logistically easier. If you want to sample parks, you need permission from one or maybe 2 people at the parks department. For private property, you need permission from every single landowner. But so much of the city is actually people's private property. So I wanted to capture that. And essentially, I went door to door. So I planned the neighborhoods I wanted to go based on criteria I established from city housing records and GIS. But then I would show up and ask permission.
So were people generally okay with that?
They actually were. So I'm a pretty outgoing person, but it takes a lot of courage still to just walk up to someone and, you know, ask for help in this really obscure way. And so I was pretty nervous the first few times, but people were incredibly generous with their time, and I was really amazed by how successful it was. And so I went to over 60 houses, and I only had one person turn me down the entire summer. And so everybody, I mean, some people were more or less enthusiastic about it, but people were very willing to kind of accommodate what I needed, which was, it was actually really nice. I got to talk to, you know, probably over 100 people during the course of that study, between, you know, going to people's doors and, you know, cemetery groundskeepers and golf course superintendents and the parks department. Ooh. Yeah, cemeteries.
At night? Just kidding.
No, I do my sampling during the day.
Okay.
But for this project, at least. But I'm really proud of that, of talking to so many people. I think a lot of people don't have personal experience with a scientist. And particularly as kind of a young female scientist, it was really important to me to make a positive impression and just show people that scientists are approachable and that we care about what's going on in the community.
Mm-hmm.
That's Sandra. Really cool. So, I had another question. How much of their yard are you, like, digging up? Is it, like, what's the surface area that you
It's a
use,
pretty
I guess?
Small. So, you can't see me gesture. So the actual soil cores that I take, at any house, I would take about maybe 6 to 12 of these small cores. They're about an inch in diameter. So it looks kind of like, you know, when you aerate a lawn and there's those little punctures in it? Similar to that, so you don't really notice. And then I would take a few slightly larger ones that are about the size of a pop can. And so those ones I actually had some gardening topsoil, and I would fill the hole back in so that they didn't have these, you know, they didn't have like a putting green on their lawn all of a sudden.
But so is it like all over the yard, or do you just do backyards or front yards?
That's a great question. And so there was a specific kind of pattern that we'd take these samples in. And so when you're planning a scientific study, you have to be really deliberate about, you know, where you take your samples and how you take your samples. And it has to be the same or as similar as possible. And so I would sample four different places in the each plot I had, or each site was 30 meters by 30 meters, which is anywhere from like 1 to 3 houses, depending on the size of the yards. And I would sample four different places within that. And so sometimes they ended up in backyards, sometimes they ended up in front yards. So I got to do a lot of just kind of like peering into people's yards, which is really fun.
Yeah, nice.
So I had a question for you. What do you do with the soil core samples once you collect them all? Do you take them back and you have to analyze them? What are you looking for exactly?
Yeah, so with these samples, I was looking for a few different things. And so one was soil carbon. And so the amount of carbon we can store in our soils and in the ground, that's less carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And so in terms of kind of fighting climate change, we want as much carbon in our landscapes as we can. So I would look for carbon. The other things I looked for were phosphorus. And in Madison, phosphorus is really important for the quality of our lakes. And so often soils store a lot of phosphorus and they hold on to it for years and years and years. And so that phosphorus, when it kind of makes its way through rainwater or runoff into lakes, can cause a lot of pollution and reductions in water quality. Mm-hmm. And so we had carbon, we had phosphorus. And the last thing I was looking for was to get an idea of kind of flood protection, or how well water moves through the soil. And so we'd look at texture, and that means how much of the soil is sand or is silt or is clay, and then also how kind of compact it is.
Right.
And so from those, we'd get an idea of if it rains here, is it more or less likely to kind of pool and flood or sink into the ground?
Okay. And we're actually going to take a really quick break before we get into your experience with bicycles, because you have some experience with bicycles, and we do want to learn a little bit about that. So we're going to play you a song, 9 Million Bicycles by Katie Melua, and we'll be coming right back after this short break.
There are 9 million bicycles in Beijing. That's a fact. It's a thing we can't deny, like the fact that I will love you till I die. We are 12 billion light years from the edge. That's a guess. no one can ever say it's true, but I know that I will always be with you. I'm warm by the fire of your love every day, so don't call me a liar, just believe everything that I say.
So when we came back, we said that we were going to talk about Carly's experience on bicycles, because we just played 9 Million Bicycles by Katie Melua. So Carly, I almost called you Katie. what do you do with bicycles? Why are we seeing all these pictures about you on a bike?
Yeah, so bicycles is one of the methods I use to do my field work. And so I mentioned at the top of the show that one of the things I study is urban heat islands and this idea that, you know, trees are really important for cooling off cities. But we wanted to know more about the details of that. And so we built a bicycle, and it started out as kind of an off-the-wall idea, you know, hey, what if instead of installing these permanent sensors around the city, you know, these weather stations that can be expensive and can be, you know, stolen or vandalized, what if we just sampled in real time by bike? And so we did it. Sure. It's essentially a weather station on a bicycle. I built it with help from Joel Lord, who's the zoology instrument maker.
Yeah.
Talk about a cool job. And so as I cycle, it takes a temperature measurement and a GPS point every second. And so I can pass through areas that have more or less trees, more or less pavement, and we can see how the temperature is changing kind of in real time. And so this is an ongoing project, so I don't have any exciting results to share with you yet, but I biked probably about 600 to 700 miles this summer.
Wow.
And all throughout the city, I kind of repeated different routes, and it was a really fun way to do field work.
Sandra.
So can you describe what the gear on your bike looks like?
Yeah. So basically, there is a bike rack, just kind of like a standard bike rack on the back. And on top of that, there's a black box. It's actually a marine battery box, if you know what that looks like. But it's kind of a waterproof black box, a little bigger than a shoebox. And inside that box, there's a data logger that has, you know, you can program it to take the measurements that you want. It has a little screen. There's also a little battery, a motorcycle battery. And all of this is wired to, there's a kind of a tall, probably about 3 or 4 foot tall kind of PVC pipe that has the actual weather station on the top. And so if you think about when people have those like flags on the back of their bike so that they're visible, like when they have like little trailers for kids or things, it's kind of the same shape as that, but it's this tall pole that instead of a flag, it has this little weather station. And it's all, I had to wire it all together so that it took the appropriate data. And so that was like a totally new experience for me, was dealing with all of these, you know, wires and monitors and very techy kind of equipment that I don't usually use. I usually have like my soil core and my measuring tape.
Yeah.
Now you can bike home with the soil core samples. You can carry more.
Maybe. I haven't tried that yet, but I get a ton of questions about the equipment on the bike, which is a really fun way to kind of incorporate science communication into your work. I'll be biking along and someone will bike up next to me and go, "What is that?" Or sometimes, you know, because we're in Madison and it's full of scientists, they'll go, "Is that a weather station?"
Like they already know.
And so, they already know what I'm doing.
That's great. So how, like, what periods of time do you go out biking? Is it like for hours at a time, or do you do like 1 hour a day sort of thing?
So, yeah, it's a good question. And so we didn't go out for too long at a time, because then you get into issues with the background temperature changing as you're biking, and it can make it really complicated to analyze. And so I'd try to keep I'd have a route planned that was about, you know, 4 or 5 miles, so about half an hour or so, and I would do a couple of those in a day, so no more than an hour or two in a day, usually during the hottest part of the day. And so I'm trying to get an idea of, you know, when it's really hot, when we have these heat waves, where are the cool spaces and what's driving that? But we also did a little bit at night as well, because you can get very different patterns in this heat island at night than the day. And so sometimes I would go around midnight and redo my bike transects then.
I have another question for you. How did you decide on what pathways you will take on this bicycle? Like, where is that?
That's a great question. And that So what we did is there's existing data that shows, you know, where all of the canopy cover throughout the city is and where all of the impervious surfaces, so basically pavement, is. And so I, you know, created a lot of maps that showed how those two overlapped and tried to pick routes that kind of spanned the whole range. So areas from, you know, all pavement with no trees to, you know, all trees and no pavement, and then everything in between, so that we could get kind of that full space. And it was kind of a combination of trying to be, you know, really scientific and choose the best possible routes, but also taking into account that you can only bike in certain places and certain directions. And so it was a little bit of trial and error to figure out those routes.
And how famous within the scientific community do you think you've gotten because of this bicycle? Like, has it really slingshotted your research out there, like, in terms of communication of
well,
science?
I don't think I'm famous quite yet, but...
radio famous, at least.
Maybe very radio locally famous. In my building, they all know that I have my bicycle. But there has been a couple of stories that have asked about it. And so the Environmental Monitor, which is kind of a science and tech magazine, did a piece recently on actually a number of people who are using these bicycles for urban ecology. And so that was really fascinating to see, like, oh, who are the other ones? I think when I have some results, maybe I'll get a little more fame then, when I can actually tell you what it means.
We'll be right on your tail for that one.
Yeah, can I come back next year?
Oh, I don't see why not.
That'd be cool.
But for now, we're going to go to Sandra's voice, and she's got a question for you.
And so our final question, what sort of impact will understanding urban ecosystem services better make the way we live as a society?
That is a great question. So I think of cities as areas where a lot of solutions are possible. And so we still have so much to learn. But in a field, you know, in environmental sciences, where there's kind of a lot of really depressing news, a lot of what I read about urban ecology and the directions we're going, it gives me hope. It's an area where we can do better, and increasingly we are. But I think the other thing to remember with cities is that, you know, I come at it very much from the field ecology side, but there's so many other aspects in terms of, you know, socioeconomics and social justice and community building that come into, you know, building a more sustainable city. And so I think something that, you know, just kind of zooming out from just my own research, my hope is that we see kind of planners and ecologists working together more closely, and that we really incorporate what we're learning about ecology into all the other ways that we think about our cities.
Yeah, great. So thank you to PhD candidate Carly Zeter of the UW-Madison Department of Zoology for speaking about her research on ecosystem services and its effect on Madison's urban environment. Bicycling towards a better future and changing the world one soil core sample at a time.
Thank you guys for having me.
And we're back on Perpetual Notion Machine. That was an interview with UW-Madison PhD candidate Carly Zeter, which originally took place on EarthSpeak Radio on WSUM 91.7 FM Madison. Thank you to Sandra Kinzer, co-host of the show, and to Dennis Schaefer for engineering tonight. I'm your host, Kai Brito, and you've been listening to the Perpetual Notion Machine,